Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Trevor Sloan, author of Doing Apologetics Without the Need for Apology, secretary on the executive board of the International Society of Christian Apologetics, and host of Think It Through here on Intelligent Interactions Radio. Be sure to listen every Monday and Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Central Time on blogtalkradio.com.
All right, we're here with Matt Coombe, Master's in Philosophy and Ethics from Biola University and PhD candidate at Liberty University in the field of theology and apologetics. How you doing today, Matt?
Hey, brother. I'm doing well. I'm excited to be on the show.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to talk about video games and Christianity and apologetics today. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, yeah, go ahead and tell us a little bit about what you have in terms of video games and apologetics.
Well, I'm not going to lie to you that when I talk about this subject, it usually catches people off guard. And I just spoke on this subject at an apologetics conference outside of Seattle. And I took a little informal survey before I started speaking, and I asked them, how many of you are surprised when you saw the title of this talk, utilizing video games for evangelism and apologetics? And nearly everybody in the room raised their hand. It's not something you usually, associate video games with apologetics. Usually it's the opposite. You see Christians, decrying video games. And don't get me wrong, there definitely are some video games out there that are deplorable. But after this presentation, hopefully you'll at least look at it in a different way. Oscar Wilde said, paradoxically though it may seem, it is nonetheless true that life imitates art far more than art imitates life. The interesting thing about that quotation is, if video games are a form of art, and you can make the argument that they are, they are something of a trendsetter, that we almost can look at them and understand aspects of life and reality.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So anyways, but before I go into it, I do want to kind of anticipate a few objections to utilizing video games that have come across, that have come up before. First one is you will see this after, every time there is some type of violent event, if there is some type of, school shooting, or if there is, people get in a fight, there will be some article that will come out online, and the article will be, video games cause violence. The problem with this is it's a problem of correlation and not causation. Because video games are so popular in our culture, the odds of somebody being a gamer and doing something bad is relatively high, not because they're a gamer, but because of the popularity. I mean, that's like saying, Adolf Hitler ate cucumbers, therefore, if you eat cucumbers, you're commit genocide. it's the same way I cannot say that video games cause me to be a pastor or an apologist, that there's no causation there, but it's simply so it's just an issue of correlation. And further, to my knowledge, humanity has never needed a reason to be violent.
No.
And then look at before there was even television. To the best of my knowledge, Cain, when he killed his brother in Genesis, it wasn't after they had a dispute while playing, Grand Theft Auto. It was because of, you know, human nature. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and then also, you know, even think about it this way. Even the Bible itself, it describes many violent acts, but it does not prescribe them. So, you know, it'll tell of, you know, someone killing someone or an army doing something, but it doesn't say go out and, you know, do likewise. And I would say the same thing would be true of video games. While some of them might describe violence, they don't necessarily prescribe it. So the classical Christian response to video games is somewhat negative. Besides the violence,
now,
we have this view.
What would you say to someone who said video games may not necessarily prescribe violence, but games like Grand Theft Auto and games of the sort, they tend to glorify violence?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think that is, that's a great argument. I play a lot of video games, but I don't go near the Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, neither do I.
Yeah, for the, not just for that reason, but also because it, not only does it glorify it, but it like sensationalizes it. And I hate sensationalism. You know, I hate the idea of let's be shocking for the sake of shocking. Anybody that does that, and you know, honestly, there are preachers that do that too. You know, they like to throw out these hot button issues, not because they really need to talk about them, or because that it's important, but they know that if they say this thing, they're gonna elicit a response, and I can't stand that. You know, it's like that's cheap and that's petty. And it's the same thing you see with those video games that glorify that violence. It's, why don't you put that effort into something real and not just shock value? You know, we don't want, you know, the whole shock jock. I mean, I'm sure if you started saying all these, like, crazy random stuff, you might increase the audience of your show. But it's probably not the audience that you'd want, and it's probably not going to have a very.
And they're probably not
going to
think very highly of me either.
No. But yeah, so I agree with that. You know, and I tend to take how I play games very similarly to how I watch movies. I always like to determine, if possible, you know, what is the intent of the movie or of the game. And that's why I also stay away from movies and games that have a strong sexual content. You know, it's really interesting. And I think, And I'll say, too, this is also a very good argument against or the severity of pornography. You know, because if I were to watch, you know, Saving Private Ryan, it's a relatively violent movie, but I would also know that no one actually died in that. It didn't portray real death. Or I could watch the Ocean's 11, and I could say, wow, they stole a lot of money. But then I would know, though, that they really didn't steal money. But with pornography, it's, wow, these people are really having sexual intercourse.
Yeah.
So it's, and then it's the same thing, too, is with movies with the very, even if it's not pornographic, but has a strong sexual content, they're still trying to elicit those same type of sexual feelings in you. So,
I was just going to say, that's a good point. I mean, for instance, when I watch a movie that's violent or play a video game that might be violent, like Call of Duty or something, I don't get the same types of horrifying feelings in my stomach and my heart that I do when I watch these, when I attempt to watch some of these videos of teenagers literally beating the crap out of their friends on YouTube. You know,
exactly.
It's an entirely different feeling. You know it's real or you know it's fake.
Exactly. And if you are ever playing a video game and you get to that point, that's when I would say, all right, that's how you know that you need to avoid it. So,
absolutely.
But the common criticisms that are usually come about is what you said, but also the claim that they prolong adolescence, are a waste of time, waste of money, can be sexist, can have anti-Christian themes, and can be crude. Well, for the last three, the idea of games can be sexist, anti-Christian, or crude, this is true, but it's not incumbent to video games. I mean, there are far more movies and books in existence that have far worse sexist themes, anti-Christian themes, and are crude. As a thing of wasting time and money, I would say, you know, it depends. If it's a level where it becomes idolatrous, then yeah, I would agree. And the reason why video games are seen as prolonging adolescence is because this is the first generation that has grown up into adults while being immersed in video games.
And I would say that what's prolonging adolescence, and to go along with your point, is not inherently video games. It's how the kids are being raised. It's the fact of the lack of discipline in the home. The fact that people aren't going outside anymore. You know, they're not enticed to grow up like we used to be 20 or 30 years ago.
It's interesting though too, because before the television was kind of the babysitter for the absent parents. Now it's become the video game console is the babysitter for the children. And in a lot of ways, I mean, I would say that's worse, because with a lot of video games, you know, you also can have online interactions. And so then now you have these, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the YouTube videos of kids playing Call of Duty online and just cussing up a storm, and you've got to think,
when they're 8 years old,
kids' parents. So it definitely is something that can be it can be bad, and it can be destructive. But my point is what if instead of disregarding video games, we were to utilize them to glorify God? Then obviously the question remains, how do we do that? And that's kind of my overarching thesis throughout this whole presentation. So I'll be explaining that in several different ways. Before I explain that, let me explain just a few benefits of gaming. Several studies have proven that gaming increases critical thinking skills, hand-eye coordination, non-linear thinking skills, and creativity. And also, too, rehab. My brother, he is a civilian worker for a local government shipyard, and he actually hurt his hand in a sandblasting accident. And so the doctor said that it was really important that once it healed, to strengthen the muscles in that hand. And we figured out that gaming was a way to strengthen those muscles in his hand again. So gaming is also very good for rehab of very specific injuries.
And let me be clear to my listeners, you're not saying that we need to go out and spend 24 hours a day or even 1 hour a day necessarily playing video games, right?
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
and it's one of those things, too. I even warned this before when I gave this lecture. If you're not a gamer or interested in gaming, don't go out and buy the latest game and then
think I'm going to go talk with the youths down at the mall because I played that duty calls.
Yeah, that's going to ruin your credibility even more.
Now I'm going to relate to the youths. And it's like, no, please don't do that. If anything, this presentation is more, I want you to be aware of these, of these themes and, at least be able to have a discussion, if not with other adults, concerning this issue. Another benefit of gaming, though, is gaming actually brings to light important philosophical issues. Have you ever interacted with the issue of or know anything about transhumanism?
Yes, you'd have to refresh my memory as to the definition, but yes.
It's got a couple different definitions or ways of understanding it. But usually it's the augmentation of humanity to something beyond its original intent. And I argue there's actually three different types of transhumanism. There's the kind of it's almost an oxymoron, but a natural type of transhumanism. We first see that with people like Alexander the Great. To Alexander the Great, if you were not a Greek, you were a barbarian. And so his idea was, let's conquer these barbarians and let them do all the work, and the Greeks will be free to study philosophy all day. So that type of transhumanism is basically eliminating the people that you think to be inferior. The second type is utilizing, I would say, demonic forces to augment humanity. The examples we'd see with that are usually related to the occult, like when you had Moses confront the magicians in Exodus, and they were able to throw their staffs on the floor, and the staffs became snakes. Well, if that really happens, now some people say that it didn't really happen, or that they were just hypnotized snakes, and I tend to believe that they really did happen. Well, that's beyond the scope of what humans are capable of doing.
Beyond human capabilities.
Correct. The third type is technological transhumanism, and this is the one that's becoming an issue right now. This is, I just got my first new car. I just bought a Jeep. I'm really excited. I really like it. Cool thing about Jeeps is you can just, tweak them out, add all sorts of stuff to them. But let's say I were to go down to, let's say, Trevor, you go out and buy a Jeep for $10,000. And then you go and take it down to a little trick shop, and they trick it out, and they add $10,000 worth of augmentations to it. Well, now you have, for all intents and purposes, a $20,000 vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, suppose that instead of going down there, you went down to the local transhumanist shop, and they added $10,000 worth of augmentations on you. Increase that hard drive brain of yours, and we could do this. Well, then, what is your worth? Anytime you say that you are making some type of addition or some type of improvement, it would necessarily result in an increased value. But since that's the point, is since humanity has no, in a sense, inherent
monetary value,
mm-hmm.
you're basically, the only thing we left to conclude was, you're worth $10,000 more than me. So anytime you start thinking in terms like that, you know, then you're going back to Alexander the Great, going back to Hitler. And it's interesting because Hitler was actually the first person, at least that I know of, that really attempted to utilize each form of transhumanism. You see the occultic aspect, you see the getting rid of the inferior genes, and you see the improvement through technology. Anyways, video games have been at the forefront of exposing transhumanism for a long time. One of my favorite games, BioShock, it does the best depiction of the deplorable state of transhumanism better than any book I've read on the subject. I've read, like, by read, I mean, like, I've, you know how like, grad students, they read a book, you know, so I've read, like, 12 books on the subject. And out of all those books, I would say that BioShock, the video game, does the best job of showing the consequences of transhumanism. They even created terms. One of the terms that they created for this game was gene trader. Like, you are a gene trader. They had these guys hung for being gene traders. They would not live up to their gene superiority, and so they were hung. So anyways, games bring to light these important philosophical issues. Also, ethical dilemmas. You know, the games like Fable, Star Wars, Knights of the Old Republic, they all deal with people having to make choices, and the choices actually result in permanent changes to your character. In the Star Wars game, if you, you know, hurt innocent people, you start, you know, your avatar is in the background, you start getting darker and darker, and you start looking, you know, more like Emperor Palpatine from the Star Wars series. You know, you look like a wrinkled old man. Same thing with Fable. You start making bad choices, and you actually start to grow horns in that game.
Wow.
And if you make good decisions, you start getting like this halo and aura of light around you. So that definitely brings up the ideas of ethical dilemmas and also the problem of evil. So now back to my main point is, how in the world can video games be utilized for apologetics and evangelism? Well, I have what I want to talk about today, and these are all very, very brief, relatively brief, just because of the short time limit we have. This is more of a survey, not necessarily talking about one subject. But the crucial areas are hero myths, and I'll explain what that means next if you're not familiar with it. Religious themes, the transcendental argument, again, I'll explain what that is as well. And also, and I think this is probably the most crucial, video games bring to light better than any other way the idea of the necessity of the creator being the redeemer. So I'll explain that. So what is hero myth? Hero myth is a set of universal characteristics or themes incumbent to legends, literature, fables, folklore, cinema, saga, and video games. It's basically what it is a form of general revelation. And of course, by general revelation, I mean how God reveals himself indirectly. The way I like to explain general revelation is, you know, if someone just poured concrete and you were to walk across it, there would be no way for you to, you know, cover up the footprints left behind. They would be okay. there indefinitely. What were you saying?
No, I was just going to say I've done that before, accidentally.
Yeah,
it was pretty embarrassing.
I've done some, yeah, I can give you a list of reasons why I'm a philosopher and not a contractor. But, yeah, so there'd be no way if you're going to walk across them to not leave evidence or not leave footprints of you being there. And that's the way I like to describe general revelation. It's how God has revealed himself just by being the creator. And this is distinct from special revelation, which is God's intentional revealing of himself. Obviously, the best example of this is the incarnation of Jesus Christ. The Word becoming flesh is the greatest example of general or special revelation. So then the question is, how is hero myth, how is that general revelation? I want to read a quotation to you. Now, before you, because at first it seems kind of iffy, but once you hear who said it and what the meaning is, it gets a little bit better. Well, I should think it's a lot better. But here it is. The heart of Christianity is a myth, but it's also a fact. The old myth of the dying God, without ceasing to be myth, comes down from the heaven of legend and imagination to the earth of history. It happens at a particular date, in a particular place, followed by definable historical consequences. We pass from a Balder or an Osiris, dying nobody knows when or where, to a historical person crucified. It is all in order, under Pontius Pilate. By becoming fact, it does not cease to be myth. That is the miracle. C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, it's C.S. Lewis, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to understand how C.S. Lewis defined the term myth in terms of Renaissance literature. You know, it wasn't the same as us. Yeah, that's a good quote.
No. Yeah, it really is great. The way that he is defining myth here is it is this eternal, universal struggle.
Yeah, it's like a story.
Exactly. And, well, let me read. I have another quote by him, a quotation by him, that actually I think does explains even more his explanation. He says, they, the myths, awaken in the reader a longing for something that is beyond his grasp. Myths have this fascination because they affect a catharsis. That is, they move us and purify us. Thus, they expand our consciousness, allowing us, through them, to transcend ourselves. So myths are not poets' descriptions, as Plato said in the Republic, nor demonic delusions, as many of the church fathers thought, nor clerical lies, as the Enlightenment figures asserted, but myth in general is, and here's the kicker, at its best, a real, though unfocused gleam of divine truth falling on human imagination.
Hmm. Yeah, so he's basically defining myth as a trans analogy, if you would.
Yes. And what I think is actually the example of this is think of the movie The Lion King. Now, what is The Lion King? It is a movie that if you look at the intent of the movie and what it was setting out to do, it was setting out to champion Eastern thought. You know, that's why, you know, you have it set in Africa. You have that guru monkey who, you know, the weirdo monkey that dances around, yep, and does his like you know, praying in quotes.
Chanting.
So you have this movie that set out to be anti-Western, pro-Eastern philosophy. The problem with that is you can never get the best possible story via Eastern philosophy, because at best, all you have with Eastern philosophy is ending in nirvana or ending in this state of
non-state of ceasing to exist.
Exactly. So, think about this, though. The intent was to have these Eastern themes, but what was the result? In the end, it has more Christian themes than anybody else. You have the sacrificial death, but yet also the resurrection, in the sense that he, you know, becomes a spirit that looks over the sun. You have the departure of the sun and the return of the sun to conquer evil and set back the balance. So in the end, you have a pretty good telling of the gospel in this story that was set out to be anti-gospel or anti-Western religious. The reason why that's the case is because of hero myth. If you want to tell a good story, you must utilize these aspects of hero myth. Because that's the case, video games present a very interesting factor of immersion. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, though. Let me explain real quick the importance of myth, of hero myth, specifically with C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis was converted in part due to his fascination with hero myth. He, as a child, you know, he studied these ancient tales. And when he was first confronted with these ideas of Christianity, what you said is the idea of myth is this overarching, what was the term you said? I don't remember now.
Story.
Meta.
Trans analogy is what I said.
Trans analogy. It was that's what won Lewis over, is he's like this overarching trans analogy of these heroes could be true if there was this meta narrative and this creator. And so that was one of the things that won him over. To him, the idea of divine hero was a huge expression of beauty and love. And in fact, we even see Lewis has his own example of hero myth in the Chronicles of Narnia. You know, he stated in his letters to children that the tale of Narnia is what he said, a way that God could have saved another world. It's basically the exact same tale of Christ, the incarnate God, dying for the population. So C.S. Lewis said this is basically a retelling of the story of Christ. It was an example of hero myth. Now, there are a couple of problems with hero myth. Let me talk about them really briefly, because I'm super behind on everything right now. But it has been utilized as a negative force against Christianity with such things as the Zeitgeist film. Are you familiar with the Zeitgeist film?
Yes and no. I've heard of the Zeitgeist.
Yeah, this too has a problem with correlation and causation. It maintains that because some ancient myths bear similarities with Christianity and Jesus, therefore they claim that Jesus must likewise be a myth. However, there's just very, very serious problems with this. I mean,
yeah.
No real, you know, even J.P. Moreland dealt with this issue a long time ago. He, in the Scaling the Secular City, he deals with this, but there's almost no scholar with a terminal degree in theology or history that holds to this. So it's, and then even Bart Ehrman, who's one of the biggest critics of Christianity, even he wrote a whole book refuting these claims. So it's kind of out to lunch.
Yeah, I mean, that's like saying that I ate an apple and I'm a human, so you must necessarily have also eaten an apple because you're also a human. That's just ridiculous.
It's a
there's no inherent correlation.
Exactly. It's, again, a problem of misunderstanding the difference between causation and correlation.
Yeah.
So let me say this then. If Lewis was so moved by merely reading of myths, how much more powerful would these sensations have been if he were to be immersed in a world of heroes and help control the outcomes of the adventure? Video games allow for hero myth immersion. So,
what would you say if someone were to say that this is true, but at the same time, video games also encourage us to be the hero instead of accepting someone else as the hero?
Well, and I'll tell you what, I think that could be definitely is a negative thing, but if taken in the right context, it allows us to be co-laborers with Christ.
Yeah,
now,
absolutely.
Christ is, he's the hero. I remember when I was in junior high, I'm a very emotional person. And I remember one time I went to my mom and I was just crying. And she's like, what's wrong? And I remember I said to her, Mom, I just want to be involved with something that is greater than myself, that is more important than myself. And I want it to be meaningful and real. Well, a few years later, Christ saved me when I was 17. I never realized that this was the fulfillment of that desire. Now, while Christ is indeed the hero, I get to partake in that adventure with him.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's pretty awesome. So
That's a good answer.
Hero myth themes, thank you. Hero myth themes and characteristics, there's five or six depending on how you define them. But number one, this is like the hero cycle is what it's called. You have the departure. Number two, you have doubt. Three is refusal. And doubt and refusal can go hand in hand. Four is empowerment, where the hero receives something that helps him complete the job. Five is conquest. And then six is return. So what does that mean, or what does that look like? Well, let's talk about one of my favorite video game characters of all time, Link from The Legend of Zelda. Have you played The Legend of Zelda games?
Indeed, I beat it on Game Boy, the original.
Nice.
I love that game. It's been a while.
So, using my favorite Zelda game, which is Zelda Link to the Past, I'm going to explain to you this hero cycle. So it starts out, and Link is sitting in bed, and his uncle, I think it is says to Link, Link, I'm going out for a while. I'll be back by morning. Don't leave the house. And obviously, because Link is the hero, he's got to leave the house. And it's funny, me and my friends, we used to joke, is if you don't hit any buttons, Link doesn't actually get out of bed. And so we like set the controller down one time. We're like, all right, we're not getting out of bed. That didn't really last very long. So anyways, so you get out of bed. That's the departure. That's the hero beginning his quest. Well, not too long later, you find your uncle, and he's basically been defeated. And he says, Link, you can do it. Save the princess. Zelda is your, and then he dies. Now, the problem with this is Zelda, or Link, doesn't ever talk in any of his games. So it's very difficult for him to express doubt or refusal because he doesn't talk. But the very fact that the man talking to him says, Link, you can do it, means that Link was doubting it in some way. So that is the example of doubt. So he departs, but then he has doubts. He's like, man, can I really do this? Can I, you know, how do I save the princess? And then you have the famous, if you played the Zelda games, when you get the sword and the original one, it says, it's dangerous to go alone. Take this. And he's given his first sword. Well, that's the empowerment there. He receives some power that helps him to complete the task. So you have the departure, the doubt, now the empowerment. He has the sword that allows him to complete his task. Then you have the conquest, where he uses his empowerment to defeat the enemy. Then once he has defeated the enemy, he returns. He returns back to his home, or returns back to some, you know, state of equilibrium. So there we have these series of events. And now my question to you is, do these series of events seem familiar? Well, they should, because Jesus fulfills the hero cycle. But think about this. We have the departure, John 1:14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Luke, and it's really interesting, actually, because with Jesus, he has two different departures. You have the incarnation, the Word becoming flesh, but then you also have him do the second departure when he says in Luke 2:49, I must be about my Father's, to the refusal and doubt. You have him saying, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Matthew 26:39. Now, it's probably not the greatest example of doubt or refusal, but you also got to remember, too, this is God incarnate. He's not really, you know, the doubting type. He's got the whole world on his side. So I use this as an example of doubt, but this type of doubt is not like you'd see really in any other notion of hero myth. He says this. Remember, anytime God reveals something, it's for our benefit. It's not for his. What you see is the intent here is he was trying to show his, or explain the importance of fellowship to the Father. And he wanted for people to realize how much he did not want to go away and be in disfellowship with the Father, which would be a part of taking on the sins of the world. Mm-hmm. All right, so then you also have the empowerment. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. So the empowerment of Jesus is, he says, hey, the God's Spirit is upon me, and through these things I'm able to do these miracles. So we have departure, refusal, empowerment. Next we have conquest. Oh, death, where is your sting? Oh, Hades, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law, but thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. 1 Corinthians 15:55-57. Amen. And then finally we have the return. That's one of the hugest aspects of Christianity. Revelation 22:7, and behold, I am coming quickly. Blessed is he who heeds the words of the prophecy of this book. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip ahead to just religious themes in video games.
Okay.
Now, resurrection is a huge, huge aspect in video games.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because death is everything in video games.
Mm-hmm.
Consider how ridiculous a game would be if there was an eternal penalty of death. For example, consider the game Skyrim. Skyrim is a huge, huge world game where, you know, you create your character, and it, you could spend 2 hours just creating your character. I remember the first time I played this, it was a while ago, or one of the earlier versions of the game, and I was still living at my parents' house at the time, and I remember I spent a couple hours working on building my avatar, my likeness. And my mom, she saw my avatar, and she asked, "How did you get a picture of yourself in the game?" I was like, "Oh, sweet, it's looking like me then." But so you can spend hours doing this, and if you were to walk from one end of the map to the other, I mean, it would take a long time, like probably close to maybe an hour of real life time just walking across the map. And the map is filled with all this detail, all these animals, these almost like these self-contained ecosystems. You see animals hunting each other and the herbivores eating grass and so forth. But now let me say, what if you start to play this game and you create your character and you were to go, and as soon as you start off in the game, let's say you take a wrong turn and you come across, you know, some level 50 dragon, and he just one-shots you and kills you. Well, what if
game over forever.
Yeah, and what if at that point the game shut off and would never turn on again?
Or what if you caught on fire and you were on fire? Sorry.
No, it's okay. Well, you understand. It basically, this lets us know the absurdity of life without God. You know, even Paul says that. He says, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, we're of all men the most pitiable. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. You know, Paul's saying, like,
yeah,
if this is it, if this is all that life is, dude, live it up. Because tomorrow we'll be dead and our minds will be gone and nothing will matter.
Yeah, and the Bible makes it clear that God is the author of life, and he sustains life and takes it away.
Yep. So,
yep.
Really, it's an example of the absurdity of life without God. Also, we have other religious themes we see in video games. The game Halo, it's one of my favorite games. Master Chief, who's the protagonist, his identification tag is John 117. Now, he's seen as a Christ-like figure. So think about this. 1 John 1:17, John 1:17, John 1:17, Revelation 1:17, which, of course, was written by John, are all key Christological texts. Master Chief sacrifices himself and even says at the end of the third game, it is finished. One of the antagonists in the game is called the Flood, and they threaten to destroy the entire galaxy. There's also themes of resurrection, prayer, heresy, and also the other antagonist's name is the Covenant. So there's all these religious themes. We also have the religious themes in video games of Shepard from the Mass Effect series. His first name can be changed when you play the game, but not his last name, not the shepherd aspect. Well, shepherd in the ancient Near East was a term to delineate nobility or kingship. Jesus refers to himself as a good shepherd because he lays his life down for his flock. Shepherd also has an immortal or synthetic and immortal or organic aspect to him. In the second game of the series, Shepard has 12 squad mates, or disciples, if you would. Shepard was betrayed, and he experienced a sacrificial death to to save the galaxy. Now, the last thing in the few minutes we have left I want to explain is the idea that in video games, we know that they must have a rational cause in order for them to make sense. That's what the transcendental argument is. So apart from video games, if someone was going to create a school of thought, they must base that school of thought off of a rational cause. I often say to someone, you know, you are free to believe that reason got here by chance or a non-rational cause, but if that's true, I would have no reason to believe your very statement. So many atheists try to claim that the beginning of the universe has a non-rational cause, but if what they advocate begins with the non-rationality, why should I believe anything that they tell me at all? I shouldn't. I mean, it's basically, yeah, you know, self-contradictory. Now, think about this when it comes to video games. If there's not a rational cause predicating a video game, not only would the game be unplayable, it would not even be able to be turned on. Mm. Now, this is a matter of metaphysical necessity. It's almost like a type of I don't want to get into this too much, but it's a type of ontological argument in many sense. So the bottom line is this: rational effects can only exist, let alone self-replicating units, unless it is sourced from a rational cause. Now, what I mean by self-replicating units would be like in the game Skyrim, you have these programs, these NPC or non-playable characters, they go out and they perform all these functions and they continue to perform them in the sense they're self-replicating. Well, the only way we could think that that would even be possible is if the game itself was based on a rational cause. Now, think about this. Suppose you are playing a video game which is not based on a rational cause. Imagine playing a video game where if you pressed on the left joystick, it made the character, let's say, take a nap. Well, even in this scenario, I have already granted an absurdly high level of rationality to the game. For if there's no rational cause in the video game, then pressing a button would do nothing. And one would not even be able to see the character take a nap. So if a game is not based on a rational cause, it shouldn't even turn on in the first place, let alone have correlating buttons result in different correlations or different effects. So the bottom line is this: if there's no rational cause to a video game, there could be no rational effect. However, video games would not exist without rational effects. Since rational effects exist, there must therefore be a rational cause. Now, if this argumentation is true of a limited and finite programming space for a video game, how much more true would it be for an infinite universe? Basically, what I'm saying is,
well, even then, you could just go from there's a rational cause for video games, and they're humans, and therefore there must be a rational cause for the rationality of those humans who are the rational cause of the video games, and that's God.
Yep. And there's I don't have time for this, but there's also very many similarities between a video game designer and God. There's issues of intentionality, design, complex designer, but also this, and this will be legitimately the last things that I say, and then maybe we'll have a couple of minutes to just chat about this, but think about this. Would it be possible for a video game character to fix an errant stretch of code? Like, let's say, you know, could Master Chief, in the middle of a Halo game, say, oh my gosh, there's a glitch over there and it's not letting me walk through this door. Let me fix
no.
this glitch. No. It would, and that brings us to the point is it would seem that no one but the designer could fix the glitch. Mm. And the same is true with this world. Considering the scope and severity of sin and death, it is quite apparent that no one but the Creator is fit to be the Redeemer. And it's
yeah.
much
and even more than just... Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. It's just, so it's like, as much as it makes sense in a video game, it would have to be true in the real world. So right away, just from this video game, I've argued pretty effectively for the necessity of Christ's deity right there. just by simple necessity, the Creator must be the Redeemer.
Hmm. Yeah, and so, I would argue even more than just the Creator having to be the one who can fix the glitch, unless someone understands the intentionality of the Creator wholeheartedly, then they wouldn't even be able to recognize the glitch in and of themselves without the help of the Creator. And so that should humble us as humans to see that we may think we understand, oh, yeah, God should have done this way, or this is messed up. Well, that's like the whole deal with the problem of evil. We may not understand it, but we don't know the intentionality of God wholeheartedly, so we need to be tentative when we talk about such things.
And that's what, you know, this does, is it kind of makes us look at the scenario that we're in and be like, oh my gosh, that makes a lot more sense. So that's why I think these religious themes in video games and this hero myth, we have to embrace them, because the generation that gets involved with video games inherently understands these things. Like, we understand the idea of sacrifice, of at least for heroes. We understand that a hero does sacrifice. We understand that, yes, the Redeemer or the Creator must be the Redeemer. We just have to be able to explain that in ways that they would understand. That's why I'm
we have to
bring
point
to
out the correlation
issue. Yes.
Yeah, that's great stuff. I really appreciate your insight on all this, Matt. We're out of time, and I hope to have you on again soon.
Hey, anytime, brother. Oh no, just thanks for the opportunity, and praise God that we're able to take something that people intended for bad and use it to glorify God.
Amen, amen. All right, Matt, we'll talk to you later. Thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome. God bless you.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.